as we have learned from reading the cases investigated by Dr. Jacques Vallée over decades, time, like space, can be manipulated in these encounters with craft, with beings. It's happened all over the world, in every culture, on every continent, in every country, throughout human history. It's, as I said before, it's not an American phenomena, it's a worldwide phenomena. And in a moment, we're going to hear some of the cases that Jacques has been investigating in Europe and South America. He'll be making a presentation about them next week at Contact in the Desert. Some of them, I suspect, will be fairly dramatic. And then we're going to get into his newest book, Forbidden Science, Volume 4, covering the decade of the 90s, a tumultuous decade, a lot of activity on these subjects, and we'll get into that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. If you're interested in catching up with Dr. Jacques Vallée, Sunday, June 2nd, is the day to do it at Contact in the Desert. He has a lecture from 2 to 4, and then the film that we've been talking about will be shown from, I think, 7 to 9, and a discussion afterward. Jacques, in your note to me earlier today, you said that you've been working on cases in Brazil and in Europe that are, as you, in the word that you used, unexpected, or at least some unexplained. Is there something unusual, or let's start with European cases. Which cases, how many, are there overall trends, and would you like to share details about any of them?
The best way I can use my time now is in motivating and helping younger people who are coming into the field, and helping them with investigations and helping them with resources or contacts. The other thing I can do is go after very special cases where I can learn something new. You know, I'm not very interested in statistics or in chasing ambulances. I really want to screen the cases that have something unique that teaches us, and sometimes they challenge us in ways that we don't expect, and that's the kind of cases that I'm interested in. That's what you do in science. I mean, you don't keep studying the same species of frogs, you know, all your life. You want to know just how many other species are there, and what do they do, and so on. And one of the problems for the military has always been, from the days of the Air Force and now the Navy, there are just too many reports, and you need to screen them. If you remember, the Robertson panel, way back in the 50s, had to do with the fact that the Air Force was getting 200 reports a day, and it was saturating their very vital intelligence and communication networks. The same problem arises today. Just ask our friends at MUFON how many cases they are able to research when they get them by phone or through email or by letters. I developed back in the 80s. I developed an artificial intelligence tool to screen data. Now, artificial intelligence is very much in the news now. It's very much fashionable, but it goes back 50 years. My doctorate was on AI at Northwestern, and it's now re-emerging as a subject of fascination for people. But one of the things you can do very simply with AI is to build a tool that helps you and will dialogue with you about the details of complicated situations, including UFOs, so that you don't have to spend a lot of time looking at things that can be explained. And we know that about 80% of all the cases are explainable. I want to focus on the others, and the others are a spectrum of mysteries. And, you know, in the old days, we started with the very natural idea that these objects were probably extraterrestrial, and it's still one of the best explanations. We know that their life must exist throughout the universe. We know that sooner or later, we're going to find a way of going out there, of leaving the our solar system. So why couldn't something come from elsewhere? And it's a very natural idea. And of course, that's what SETI is looking at. And a bunch of astronomers are looking at this and so on. And it's always true. However, what we've learned in the last 50 years is that the phenomenon doesn't follow those patterns. It's much more rich. It's much more complex. It doesn't behave like either an invasion or an exploration by one or two or three other races. And when you really look at the details are extraordinarily rich and important for science. And I think that's, you know, that's my main message, is that, you know, scientists should be able to start looking at this without controversy, without ideology, without presupposition of, you know, one or another particular theory. Now, I'm going to be focusing on five cases. First I'm going to talk about AI very briefly to show how we now have the tools to screen the important cases from the ones that are trivial or are explainable. And by the way, the Navy could use that. Maybe I should sell it to the U.S. Navy.
I can set you up.
You don't want to spend a lot of time sending investigators to look at a case where somebody just saw the moon rising through a layer of fog. You want to spend your time on cases that may be important for either for science or for national security. Now, the three cases in Brazil illustrate the differences between the kind of situations that are being reported in our media, either on television or radio or in the newspapers in the U.S., and what happens in the rest of the world. And the phenomenon is able to, as we said earlier, as you said, quoting Mr. Bigelow, I mean, it's a display. And it's a display that presents differently to the military than it does to civilian populations, than it does to an individual, a kid who is lost in the fog, like Juan, or to people in Russia or to people in Brazil. The cases in Brazil are often violent to the point of causing injuries or death. And I want to talk about a couple of those cases. We're still investigating them with friends down there, and it's difficult. You have to understand the culture within which those cases are reported. And you have to place it in the context of a society where the ways of reporting things and the way of handling the situation is of course very different from what we have in the U.S. One of those cases interested me especially because it's a case of a woman whom I met who, while she was pregnant, had a mark that appeared on her skin, on her hip. And you'll see the mark, and it's typical of a range of things that, quite apart from UFOs, have been noticed throughout the world. We've accumulated a catalog, a small database, of a few hundred cases. There are organizations, just like UFO groups, that have specialized in gathering those cases and interviewing the people. I've interviewed a number of them in France and in the U.S. Essentially what happens is that most of the people reporting those are women, as in this Brazilian case. They take a shower and they suddenly notice something either on their arms or on their upper body that is a circular pattern, sometimes different circles embedded within circles with some rays across it, like a star, with a number of circles around it. And It's not always exactly the same pattern. It's not the pattern of that you would get, for example, if you put a hair dryer on your skin. It wouldn't do that. The hair dryer has a pattern like that, to avoid your getting burned. And it's not the same pattern. And nobody has any idea how those things happen. They simply show up. And here, that in that particular case in Brazil, we have both an observation of, something that can only be described as an alien, essentially a UFO contact experience, and a mark, which is the only case I know where the two are in the same situation, in the same person, in the same patient, if you will. That woman had a baby, a normal baby, and the baby had the same mark. And we don't know what that means. But in her case, at least, it's linked in her own history. It's linked to what she saw, to the observation that she and her husband made. The other two cases, I'll wait to describe them at Contact in the Desert, because you have to see the photographs.
Okay. Let me ask you this.
They are violent.
Your history goes back a long ways with Brazil. You've gone down to investigate other cases where there is physical harm, Colares, and going way, way back. What is it about the
Rio that, where the to my surprise, the Rio police asked me to reinvestigate. It was a cold case for them. Two men had died in completely unexplained circumstances on top of a hill above Rio. And we went back with a couple of Brazilian ufologists and with the police and with an interpreter, a French interpreter for me. And that was extraordinary because it was a case where two men had died in an area that was deserted. At the same time, when witnesses had described essentially a very large disc over that hill in Niterói, which is a suburb of Rio de Janeiro. And that was an experience that, the kind of thing that where you have to understand a lot about the culture before you can put things in perspective and begin to investigate it.
I'm wondering why it seems different in Brazil than it does other places, or is it just a reporting mechanism that the same kinds of things happen here, just we don't hear about it?
No, I think it is different. It is different in Brazil. Brazil has a very complex, very colorful culture, very extraordinarily spiritual, and you have to integrate this. Many families in Brazil will go to a Catholic mass in the morning and to an Umbanda ceremony in the evening. And the symbols cross over. There are statues there that could serve in either religious context. And so you have to, and I have the privilege of being able to go twice to the interior of Brazil. And what I'm going to be reporting, the three cases that I will be mentioning, are all in the same area. Now, an area in Brazil is something where you may have to drive for 3 hours from, to get there, but it's still known as the same area because Brazil is just so vast and so diverse in culture. And but all those cases are in the Northeast, which is not the jungle. I mean, it's not the Amazon. It's an agricultural area, very, very beautiful, with some large cities. We think of of Brazil as populated with a sparse population in small towns, but there are very large cities there with well-organized groups, that study the phenomenon, and I've been working with them.
I read this online journal, Inexplicada, that covers South America, Central America cases of interest, and a lot of cases of animal mutilations popping up in Argentina. And I don't know if it just decided to migrate from this country or we don't get it reported here anymore and it's suddenly down there. But are you familiar with what's going on there? And is it associated with UFO activity as well?
I've asked that question. And the mystery is the same there that that it is in the U.S. We don't know if phenomenon is of human origin. It seems to be, as you know from the studies that have been done on the ranch in Utah, where we had mutilations. It's very difficult to pinpoint the exact nature of what happened. And you could argue that it's a very sophisticated human operation, except that nobody can have... Nobody has an idea of why somebody would do that again and again and again. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but the patterns are there. And, of course, I asked that question in Argentina and in Brazil. And, yes, those things happened there. And they are not not animal sacrifices of some cult. They are linked to events that have not been explained. The question is there more that has to do with humans? And that's a question that you have to ask in Brazil. We didn't have to ask that question in the U.S. So we can draw a line. When you get to a culture like Brazil, you cannot draw the line. At least I don't know how to draw the line.
It seems like the cases that interest you these days are the ones with multiple phenomena involved. The kind of things that you and the NIDS team and then the BASS team encountered on the ranch were there's a range of activity. It's not just a light or an object in the sky. It's other what we'd call paranormal or supernatural weirdness surrounding it.
Well, I like the word paranormal, although... What is paranormal today may be the normal of tomorrow. The way technology is moving, there are a lot of things that our parents would have thought were paranormal that are routine for us now. So things are moving and all those boundaries are getting blurred. But again, I'm mostly an information scientist at heart still. And so I look for patterns, and when I can see a bridge between two very different phenomena that people have not connected, if I can connect them, that's the way you solve problems.
We'll come back to that in a moment, talking with Dr. Jacques Vallée. Still to come, a discussion about his new book, Forbidden Science, Volume 4. Our pal Robbie Williams tearing it up. Take us into the break with Let Me Entertain You. We're talking with Dr. Jacques Vallée. His new book is called Forbidden Science, Volume 4, Journals from 1990 to 1999. We'll get into that in a second. Before we do, I want to ask him about French UFO cases. If you heard the beginning of our interview, Jacques mentioned that the French have an organization that studies these mystery aircraft and surrounding phenomena. The French military cooperates, reports cases that come its way. And lo and behold, people did not panic. They didn't head for the hills. The sky did not fall. Seems like it could work elsewhere. We're going to get into that, maybe touch on the Utah ranch a bit more, and then into his journals in our last segment with Dr. Jacques Vallée. Stick around. Jacques, in your new book, Forbidden Science, Volume 4, you talk about your experiences with NIDS. As we know, one focus for NIDS was the Utah ranch. That was studied not only by NIDS, but later by BASS, under this program that they had going with the U.S. government, the DIA. You are familiar with the range of phenomena on that property. There's sort of an interactive quality to it. It seems to react to people and in strange ways, and it when I've tried to put a positive spin on explaining it, it almost seems like a learning curve. I don't know if that's wishful thinking or not, but the displays that were there, it seemed to be for the benefit of humans. And I wonder if that is unique, or if you think that that is across the board why many people have these experiences.
I don't think it's unique. I think that there are regions of the world where phenomenon seems to be more likely to happen, or perhaps more likely to be reported. I think the situation at NIDS, I think we perturbed the situation when we got there. I don't think Mr. Bigelow would disagree with that statement. I have not followed what has happened there. I have not followed what happened there after NIDS. I only went there, there was a period when BAS was in operation, where I did not go to the ranch at all, but I did something else thanks to a scientist in Utah named Dr. Frank Salisbury, who is was a well-respected biologist, who was involved in some of the biology experiments in space for NASA. He was also very well introduced through his earlier books with both the native population in Utah and the Mormon population in Utah. And I had the privilege of going on two series of expeditions, you could call it, with him throughout the, we crisscrossed the northern half of Utah together for two trips of about 10 days each, revisiting the people he had interviewed before, about 30 years before, for his first book. And again, seeing what had happened over the long time. And we were greeted everywhere because of his very open and wonderful, warm contact with people. We were welcome everywhere with open arms. And again, human trust is really the key in getting to the truth of these mysteries. And it was extraordinary. And what I remember from that, and that's never been written anywhere, by the way, but what I remember from those two trips is that what happened on the ranch happens outside the ranch as well. It happens all over that region in pretty much the same way, including sightings of, as you know, the Skinwalker, which relates to Indian legends that go way back. So again, it's a complex culture that is both very modern and very old, and crosses linguistic boundaries and belief systems and religious boundaries. It's absolutely fascinating. And the ranch, of course, is in the middle of all that. When I think it was pure genius, I think, to buy that property and to instrument it the way it was done. In my book, this volume is a chronology of the scientific attempts by a very extraordinary group of scientists. And how often are you invited every 2 months to meet with a group that of about 15 people that crosses over all the scientific disciplines? There were three physicists from Los Alamos. There was a mathematician involved in fundamental mathematics. There were two of the astronauts who had walked on the moon. And then there were Air Force people and people from the intelligence community. And then generalists like Peter Peterson and myself and a few others. And there were people studying the survival of death and parapsychology. Now, how often can you get a group like this to work together for, the most of 10 years?
Well, it was extraordinary. I got to be a fly on the wall and worked for NIDS for a couple of months on some projects. And it was extraordinary, extraordinary time. You, of course, have heard some of the criticisms that have arisen in the years since about Mr. Bigelow and NIDS. It's a front for the CIA. They always describe Bob Bigelow as shadowy and that he wants to capture the technology and leave Earth, or, you know, all kinds of crazy stories. That was an extraordinary group of people put together. And, you know, the ranch offered a unique opportunity. I know that, as you describe it in your book, you know, there was debate within the Science Advisory Board about how to approach it. There were differences of opinion. Do you go in soft or do you go in hard with technology and cameras and measuring equipment as opposed to psychics, shaman, or just low tech? Which side were you on?
There are some aspects, as you'll see in the book, that where I disagreed with the approach that was eventually taken of fairly overt means of monitoring the property, and I don't know what has been done since then. But my approach, which I was pretty vocal about, as you'll see, sometimes against the inclinations of the group or those of Mr. Bigelow, my approach would have been very, very discreet and very low-key. We have sensors now that can acquire information in many different ways that would not have fooled the phenomenon. The phenomenon is very, very good at detecting you and detecting your sensors, as it showed in some of the things we've never explained that happened. I would have instrumented the cattle to keep track of them if they were messed with. We knew that something was going to happen to the cattle, and it did. I think we could have better protected those animals, and we could have tracked them much better to get to a level of information. But the other side was, let's allow it to be loose, and let's see what the phenomenon does with it. And I could argue both. Looking back, and I'm very proud, by the way, that my book is the only record of pretty much every session we had.
Yes.
And I see on the web that Keith Basterfield has reanalyzed everything from the book and summarized it extremely well. And it shows the tensions. It shows the different ways that we, you know, some of us, like Dr. Pudoff or like Senator Schmidt, or like, you know, would have instrumented the ranch. I think we learned a lot. And, you know, like everything else, like Silicon Valley, you learn from your mistakes. I think the criticisms are partly legitimate. And we had the same, I mean, we came up with a lot of criticisms within the group. It was a very open group, and that's the way it was run. But it was a research, you know, it was a research committee that had funding responsibility and monitoring responsibility and reporting responsibility. And it was, you know, Mr. Bigelow is an extraordinary manager. What he does now in space is, again, is extraordinary. And what he has already done and what he's planning with his team. However, scientific research cannot be managed the way you manage an engineering project or a construction project. And you need to have room to fail. And so we failed, and then people are coming out and say, ha ha, you know, you failed in this particular case. Well, we did, you know, we failed and we learned something, and next time maybe we'll do it differently.
I mean, that's how progress is made, right? That's how science works.
It's a
series of failures until you don't fail anymore.
You know, the religion I've learned in Silicon Valley is fail often, fail quickly. What you don't want to do is fail over the long time. If you're going to fail, you know, you want to get the best people, And then you have to give them the freedom to fail. And when they fail, you learn something, and that's how you get the great companies like Google and Apple and the others. Look how many times Apple has failed.
I want to bring it back to where we started, the discussion about the Nimitz Tic Tac incident, or, you know, this craft is seen, and it's sort of, I don't know if it's pretending like it's there and, oh, gosh, you caught me red-handed, I'd better get out of here. It sort of seems like it's a play, again, a display, a performance, much like what was seen at the ranch over and over. It was seemed to be phenomena for our benefit to teach us something or to get our attention or I don't know what it was, but you get the same sense that that's what was going on there in Utah, that it was trying to teach us something, a learning curve, get our attention for some reason that we haven't figured out?
Well, I think you're putting your finger on something that's critical here, because in science, you approach a phenomenon that is usually repeatable. I mean, there are exceptions to that. I mean, in astronomy, there are things that are not repeatable and so on. But usually you learn how to design an experiment so it can be verified, monitored, and repeated, and shared with other teams. In this case, I'm convinced that we are dealing with a form of intelligence that is in many ways superior to us. The question is it trying to teach us something? It's not trying to destroy us, which is why we haven't reacted. That was the main reason the Air Force wanted to get out of the business, because they said we have more important things to do in terms of national security. The Nimitz is 15 years ago. Well, you know, where are they now? I mean, they haven't destroyed us. They did show up in other places. But let's put it in perspective. What happened in the ranch was theater, in part. I mean, there was that incident where a cable was cut, and here I'm proud of one thing, one little thing I did. We wanted to have, against my advice, a group wanted to have a ring of cameras on poles that would monitor the property. Well, you know, that's pretty obvious. It's pretty, it sticks out of the ground, and you have this device on top with a cable. And I said, well, if we do that, let's have some of the cameras pointing to the other cameras. So let's have a second ring of cameras watching the first cameras. And in fact, something happened to the first ring of cameras. It wasn't exactly a ring, but, you know, I'm simplifying here. But one of the cameras had the cable cut, so the transmission was cut. But we had another camera that was watching it, and on that other camera, we should have seen somebody with a ladder or something going up the pole with a knife or something and cutting that cable. We don't see anything on the other camera.
Yeah.
And that is a puzzle that, to my knowledge, we've never solved. There were a number of other things that happened like that with the animals. Animals that disappeared, including some very large bulls that disappeared and then reappeared where we should have known where they were. And, okay, so you could build a scenario where maybe there is some intervention by somebody somewhere, a human intervention playing games, but you cannot explain that category of games.
I want to ask one other topic. I suspect there's not much you can say about this, but the last time you and I talked, you made an outright appeal to the public for materials, for strange materials that maybe Granddad had picked up somewhere and stashed in a drawer. Mystery metals, metamaterials, strange stuff with a strange history, because you wanted to analyze it. Are you still asking for that material? And is there anything you can say about the material that you've been able to analyze?
So this is And that's one of my points of friction, I would say, with TTSA. I mean, TTSA has announced that they had a brand new project to look at materials. Well, people have been looking at these materials for 40 years, and the results have been published. Dr. Peter Sturrock at Stanford, who is a physicist, was my boss for a while at Stanford before I got caught into the ARPANET and the internet, had published a number of articles in the scientific press about materials that he collected and the methodology that he developed to study those materials, and I was involved in those studies. There are a number of those cases that have been analyzed and published in France, in Brazil, and in other countries, so this is not new. If you remember, there is a well-known case in Brazil, in Ubatuba, right, where some pure magnesium was picked up, we believe, in 1957. That material was analyzed and was proven to be more pure than the Dow standard for magnesium. And so why would somebody drop that? And people saw an object that essentially disintegrated over a beach in Ubatuba, showering the town and the beach and the sea with magnesium. That was picked up, and there were very few fragments of it that came to the United States, were studied by a very good UFO group called APRO in the 50s and 60s, and then Stanford had a few of those fragments and studied them. I went back to Argentina in connection with the investigation of the case we've discussed, the case of Juan Perez, and I visited a place where they still had some of that material from two different sources. So now we have plenty of it, and we are, in fact, reinvestigating that case in Ubatuba.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're running out of time here. If somebody has something strange like that, you'd still like to have it?
Yes, yes. Okay. And we have new instruments and new methodologies to study that are state-of-the-art in Silicon Valley.
Great. Well, we have contact information for Dr. Vallée on the Coast to Coast website. If you've got something that dad or granddad stashed away from a strange place, let us know about it. Jacques, I can't thank you enough for being here. It's always a thrill. I can't wait to have you back, and maybe we can talk about some results from those tests the next time.
Absolutely.
You're here. Thank you very much. Check
thank
out
you,
Forbidden. Thank you. Forbidden Science Volume 4 is the book, and Witness of Another World is the film we talked about. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. John Alexander.